You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Today we're going to be talking to four different filmmakers whose work is being shown in the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. Lots of good stuff. Stay with us. Did you know the first computers were not invented by human beings, but by nature? On Tuesday, October 22nd at the Lensic, scientist Jessica Flack will talk about how nature computes, from cells to neurons to bees to humans. This free talk, The Collective Computation of Reality in Nature and Society, is part of the Santa Fe Institute's Community Lecture Series. Reserve your free seats at ticketssantafe.org. I'm very happy now to welcome Sandy Whitehawk and Drew Nichols. Drew is director of the film Blood Memory. It's a documentary whose main character and subject is Sandy Whitehawk. Welcome, both of you, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us. It's good to be here.
Great to have you. It's such an interesting film. I think many of our listeners probably know about the era when Native American children were taken away from their families and tribes and put in boarding schools, which were often abusive and which were designed to destroy their cultural heritage and to really take away their native and tribal identities. But less well known than that whole story, I think, is the practice that you talk about in this film, which is the widespread practice of adopting Indian children into white families. Tell us about this whole phenomenon.
It started informally before it started formally, around the 40s. Children started being taken away from their communities by social workers, tribal social workers and non-tribal social workers. But the real systematic removal began with the End and Adoption Project that started in 55. In answer to, I guess, what they saw as harsh conditions on the reservation, they saw the poverty and the way families were living as a real detriment to Indian children. And they thought that having them being raised away from the reservation in white communities, that they would have opportunity that they wouldn't have living on the reservation, or that they would be cared for. And in fact, they even planted the seed that white people would be able to love our babies better than their Indian families could love them. The Indian Adoption Project was a marriage of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Child Welfare League of America, and they were responsible for adopting 395 children at that time. And right after that, another organization called ARENA came to be, and they really took this removal to another level by training Catholic Social Services, Lutheran Social Services, and other private adoption agencies about what they saw as this need of having to remove children and finding homes for them. So we were targeted for removal across all the nations during that time.
And this happened to you, Sandy. Tell us a little bit about your story.
So I was born in 1953 on the Rosebud Reservation, and I was adopted out when I was 18 months old. I returned to my family in 1988. And as I started piecing my story together about my family, I came to understand that while my family was struggling like many other families on the reservation, I had a very strong extended family who were quite capable of taking care of us. But because white social worker standards were being placed on Indian families, because my mother didn't have her own apartment or house, whatever, they saw that as her not providing for me. And so they didn't see at that time aunts, grandmas, cousins caring for their relatives as a viable and healthy way to maintain family and take care of family. And so I was removed from my family and adopted out to a white missionary couple that eventually they moved to Wisconsin where I grew up.
And the way the movie is made, it makes it really clear that you didn't have a very strong connection with that family, especially the mother, and you make the point that once a kid is adopted and all the papers are signed, there's nobody checking up to see if that family is good for the child.
Right. There's no legal mechanism. Once the adoption is finalized, that child basically belongs to that family. I'm not a lawyer, but what I see the dilemma in, or the legal barrier in, is adoptions based in property law. So the child then becomes the property. That's why there has to be termination of parental rights, so that that child is not owned any longer by their birth family and can now be owned by another family. So what we don't have in place, and we could put it in place, that if a tribal child is adopted, I believe we could, through our sovereign status, develop law and policy to continue to follow the life of the child that's being placed to ensure the child is safe.
Yeah, there's an issue that I didn't know about, which is the distinction between race and, you know, what they call blood quantum, the amount, the percentage of Indian blood that a person might have on the one hand, and then political affiliation on the other. So when a child is born into a tribe and then adopted out, that child is still, according to this argument, a citizen of that tribe, the way somebody might be a citizen of a particular country. What is your understanding? Drew, do you want to weigh in on this? What's your understanding of that issue?
It's an extremely complicated issue. The way that it plays out in the film, we tried not to go too deeply into the political piece of it because it's complicated. And I mean, it's a systematic erasure, that the idea of over generations of time, the blood quantum would become lesser and lesser, to the point where indigenous people would not be legally on paper Indian enough, so to say, to lay claim to the sovereign status, whatever that might entail. So for us, it was just sort of a factor into this idea of blood memory. And one thing that came up in the Baby Veronica case, where the blood quantum was heavily debated because the court said she was only 1.2% Cherokee, but she's still a citizen of that tribe. And so a lot of the question around that started to become like, well, at what point does this blood memory kick in, right? At what point is she Indian enough? And that really became a huge, not so much a legal argument, but an argument that the public was having in the public court, so to say. So we just felt like that had to be part of the story as much as it was.
The Supreme Court had no standing to make a judgment on that. It just broke Indian country's heart to hear that, how they quoted her blood quantum and how on Dr. Phil, you know, searched for families. And he said, have you told Dr. Phil how much Indian blood this child has? Talking about her like she's a pedigreed horse, that if she's a certain amount of blood, she's no longer Indian. And that's exactly where blood quantum science came from. It was designed by a breeder of quarter horses. And it was indeed designed to breed us out of sorts. So the further they could get us away from being in our communities, the better chance that existed. But we in our communities do not define each other by blood quantum.
Right, right. But at the same time, the film is called Blood Memory, and
yep,
that it's so interesting to see how you kind of went about healing and connecting with your roots. You found some family members. What was that whole process like? I mean, it started when you were in your mid-30s when you first went back home.
It was overwhelming to have my uncles and my aunts, but in particular my uncles, who remembered seeing me, holding me, playing with me, look at me, take their time, and then smile and go, oh, yes, because they saw my mother's eyes. They saw their sister. They saw their sister in me. And so they smiled big, and there isn't any words for that. And when I saw my brother for the first time, I felt like I saw myself for the first time. And it's, I don't know how to describe it, but it was a affirmation that I was somebody. Up until that point, I wasn't anybody. I wasn't white. I wasn't Indian. I didn't know how to be either one. So they're bringing me, you know, telling me, make sure you come back to Rosebud Fair every year. That's when you meet your family. You're welcome here anytime. This is your home. Don't ever tell anybody you're Sioux. You're Lakota. Sioux is the word the white man gave us. We're Lakota. Things like that, telling me that on the first meeting, first few meetings that I had with them, educating me who I am. Yeah, it was an affirmation that I was indeed Nina Whitehawk Daniel's daughter and that I was from this place.
Yeah. Well, and you went on to awaken a lot of Native people to the importance of bringing adoptees home and acknowledging them when they come home. And you kind of liken it to returning veterans. I thought that was so interesting. How do you go about welcoming people back to their roots?
Well, I didn't wake up and say, this is what I want to do and I know how to do it. But the short, very short version is I shared with an elder, Chris Lee, who's from the Prairie Island, Dakota, Korean War veteran and a healer. And at the time, he was also the spiritual advisor to the National Indian Child Welfare Association. And he asked me a question, you know, about my going home and 1 year. And I shared with him something that was very profound experience, and I shared that with him. And that's when I said, I've never seen a welcome home for our adoptees. And I know that at every powwow, there's people that were adopted out or raised in foster care looking for relatives. And what if we took a moment and said, and had a song? Because I know that by then I was powwow dancing, I was in the color guard, and I knew that we acknowledged and held each other up and encouraged each other in our social gatherings. I got done telling him my thoughts, and he said, well, you're right. We should do this. And he basically laid it out how it was going to happen and how we were going to go about doing it. And he's since passed. But the man who made the song for adoptees, Jerry Dearly, and I took that work forward. And it's just very simple. It's at our gatherings, bringing them out into the center so people can see them. But see them in a best way. See them in not them trying to gain attention. It's just acknowledging this person has had this experience of separation and extreme grief. And as relatives, we see you. We acknowledge you. We acknowledge what you've been through. And we're welcoming you back through this song. We're going to shake your hand and welcome you home. And that's basically how we do it.
There's a moment in the film where people are sharing stories of their childhoods, people who'd been adopted out of their tribes. And there's so much trauma. There's so much pain there. And also so much healing in this act of coming back together.
Yes, we did a study, my organization, First Nations Repatriation Institute, and the University of Minnesota, I knew that most of the adoptees I had been meeting over time had experienced some sort of abuse in their family, some sort of neglect, and that they struggled with addiction and suicide. And so we put this study together, and we found that out, that out of 95 respondents in our study, 43 said that they experienced physical abuse, 47 physical abuse, and 23 sexual abuse. And this is where it got me thinking about and making sure I always say, we don't know that the homes that we're placing these children in are indeed safe in the long term. And the suicide rate is high as well. 41 of the 95 said they had contemplated and planned suicide out of 95. 41. That's a huge number. It's got to be a lot higher than the average individual. And 20 said that they had attempted. So it's very important that when we meet an adoptee, whether or not their experience was one of abuse, one of the things that we know is that even in the midst of very healthy, well-balanced, unconditional love, adoptees will still experience grief and loss of their identity of who they are.
Yeah. I wanted to ask both of you, what are your hopes for this film?
First and foremost, once we understood what the film was potentially going to be and what we were stepping into, there's a great article as Sterling Harjo, a filmmaker out of Oklahoma, is quoted, where he says, you know, he's been approached by producers, by filmmakers, non-Native filmmakers, asking him to be producers on their projects, you know, and things like that. And he says the number one question he always asks them is, what is your film doing for the community? If it's not there to do something for the community, what is the value of it? And so many non-Native filmmakers like myself come in from the outside, do a fly-by-night film, and don't think about the long-term impact of whatever trauma they're resurfacing, whatever impact that story being told and shared is going to have. And so that was something we very much considered throughout the development. And we started to ask experts in the field, whether it be social workers, tribal child welfare practitioners, you know, lawyers, what do you need from this film? What do judges need to be educated on? What do lawyers, what do you need as a training? But then also from those who live the experience, where's the limit on what you're willing to share and can't share publicly? Because this will be shared nationally. And their influence over the 9 years of making this project is really what guided our guidelines of our goals, you know. And so basically we wanted to create a tool that could be used in all these different areas that could help wake people up to this issue that don't know about it, but then also give them ways of understanding the other side of the coin and how to navigate that experience with the community. But then also in the communities, people not talking about it and it being sort of this suppressed piece of their family history, and figuring out how that gets resurfaced and how those conversations happen in the community without it being negative. So those were sort of the goals that we set out with. And so far, we have been able to do that. Sandy's able to take the film and do a lot of trainings and community sessions and help people sort of resurface this trauma in a really positive way. So that's like above and beyond anything we could have imagined the film would be able to do.
Right. Sandy, any last words about this film and your hopes for it?
My ultimate first goal, because of the generation that's beginning to leave us, our mothers and our grandmothers, that those who lost us to adoption or foster care, for whatever reason it was, that they're able to leave this world without that shame or guilt on their shoulders, that they could leave regardless of what our situation was when we were taken. It wasn't them who did that to us. And I want them to feel good that they gave life and that we're here. And that the fathers who've been left out of the picture, fathers who weren't even told we existed, would find us. We'd find each other. And that we would begin in a very meaningful way to heal this part of our family circle.
Sandy Whitehawk and Drew Nichols, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is once again accepting scholarship applications, and Northern New Mexico residents are invited to apply. Deadline for undergraduate scholarships is the 21st of January, 2020. Deadline for Career Pathways Scholarships in support of two-year degrees, certificates, and trades is November 17, 2019. Criteria and application for both may be found at lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. I'm very happy now to welcome Deborah Eisenstadt. She's writer, director, producer, and editor of the film Imaginary Order, which is screening at the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So this is a narrative film about a middle-aged suburban housewife who's kind of going down a crazy path. She's stepping outside the bounds of her kind of normal, predictable life. Was there a particular inspiration for this story?
I really wanted to write a mother character that I hadn't seen before, or really more of the experience of what it feels like sometimes when you're a parent. Particularly, I was interested in women who sort of come off as invisible or feel invisible in the world. And it could be because they abandon their career to raise their kids. And I wasn't really seeing that, this specific kind of anxious feeling that comes with motherhood sometimes, especially when there's transitions going on. I feel like kids change so quickly. And when you're a parent, it's hard to catch up sometimes and know where they're at. And sometimes the people that are closest to you, if you're in a long-term marriage or with your children, you could feel very estranged. And so the circumstances in the film are at a point in time when this woman is feeling really estranged from the people that are closest to her. And I thought that was a good environment to create a drama. That was sort of what I was trying to write.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, as I was watching it, I was thinking about that book, The Feminine Mystique, which came out more than 50 years ago. But here's a portrait of a housewife who is in a bit of a golden cage. And I felt, you know, I couldn't tell whether it was like it felt retro or whether this is just a continuation of that kind of phenomenon that has been going on for really since the kind of post-World War II era.
Well, I do think it's a myth that you can have everything and that you can really be a good mother and have a really, you know, skyrocketing career. I mean, some people make it appear that that's possible, but I just, you know, having kids myself and trying to have a career, I just know from my experience, I can only write from my own experience, that it just seems mythical. It doesn't seem possible. There's only so many hours in the day to get things done and to pay attention to people that you need to pay attention to, whether it's your people at work or people at home that you gave birth to. I just don't think it's really possible. And I think some women make the choice to focus on being a good parent and being around when their kids get home from school and talking to them and just having, and in those circumstances, you know, if you've done a good job as a parent, you do become obsolete at some point, and your kids are independent and they don't need you. And so at this point in time, the daughter's individuating and wants to push her mother away, and her mother has abandoned herself. You know, I think it's a really delicate balance. So I do think it's both retro and it's just the way it is.
Yeah.
for parents, whether it's a father who's a stay-at-home dad or a mother who's whoever's the more primary caretaker. I think it's inevitable if you have if you have a heart and you love your children, it's heartbreaking no matter what, you know, whether you're working or not, when they just are pushing you away.
The lead role of Kathy is acted by Wendy McClendon Covey, and she plays the character so beautifully. She's like this combination of smart and organized and competent on the one hand, and then, as you say, kind of unfulfilled and lost and becoming obsolete and frankly bored. And she starts acting out, like doing little things that can't be undone, and then bigger things, and then making some really stupid choices, but also not losing it entirely. And I don't want to spoil the film for other people who are going to see it, but I found myself, first of all, bracing for the absolute worst case scenario and cringing, like screaming at the movie going, "No, Kathy, don't do it." But, you know, I was wondering, like, for you as a writer, how did you decide how much of a catastrophe she was going to cause and how much she might hold back so the characters, you know, don't completely implode?
Well, I think it's really tricky when you're writing a character with lots of flaws to make them empathetic to the audience. And that is also a goal, is to not have just black and white characters, but to have characters that are really complicated and who are very real and human and make mistakes, but are still, you can understand them and they're universal and specific at the same time. So I was just trying to really cut out a moment for these people in this world that I've created, which is slightly heightened but very grounded and real. And it's also, it's a lot about addiction. And there's no talk of what she did in the past, but you see in the present what she's doing alludes to stuff in her past. The way she gets seduced by the neighbors says something about her past. And I think I was trying to write something very present tense that also could explain things about her that are not never said. Does that make sense?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's this moment where her crazy neighbor, who is very addictive, this woman, very compelling, very beautiful, and it's like smoking cessation day, and Kathy takes her cigarettes away from her, and then you see her like trying to figure out what to do with these cigarettes. And there's a lot of humor in the film, which I guess is intentional, even though it's not a straight out comedy.
Yes, I do want it to be funny, because I do think there's a combination of genres going on, but that's also because I feel like in life, the different people you meet are like different genres. You know, you can meet someone who's more of a horror movie and meet someone who's more of a comedy, and you have people coming in and out of your day that kind of carry around different themes with them. And I tried to bring that feeling into the film, where everyone sort of carries a different genre with them into her world, because she's in every scene. And there is a mix of comedy and horror and drama going on throughout the movie, different threads depending on which characters you're dealing with.
Right, very much so. And then these two adolescent characters, her daughter and then this crazy lady's son, who, well, let's not say what happens, because we should go see the film. But I did want to ask you, I mean, we're here talking about independent films, and you played a lot of roles on this film. What were the biggest challenges of making this movie, and what have been the biggest positives also?
Well, making the movie itself was really challenging, because we had so little time, money, and we shot 200 scenes in 15 days with no overtime.
Wow.
And that really was challenging and difficult. And just raising the money initially. Initially, I had a producer attached that wanted to make the film for a lot of money. That money never came together. And finally, I just got so frustrated. So much time had passed that I just took charge and produced it myself, and got financiers and another producer to come on. And I think it was just the challenge of, like, how are we gonna make this? Which I know a lot of independent filmmakers, you know, have that same challenge. It's not unique to independent film. It's just when you've been working on something for so long, at some point you're just like, I'll make this any way I possibly can, because it's taken up so much of my time already. I've got to make it. And that was sort of the attitude that I went in making it. And luckily, if you find actors that are as passionate as you, and you find people as passionate as you to do all the tasks on the film, and there are so many, you just have to find the right people that are as hungry to make something and be creative and share, collaborate. It's about collaboration. Yeah. Even though I'm doing a lot of different things, I'm collaborating with all the different people who have worked on it and put their time and energy into it.
And I guess that's part of what the big positives are, that you have that control, really.
Yeah, the control, the autonomy is really great. I don't know if I'd want to trade that in.
Right.
You know, so it is worth it in that respect.
Anything else you want to let us know, or anything else you want to talk about this film, Imaginary Order?
I think another thing that I think is important when you're watching the film, that this is very much about the stoicism of motherhood. It's taken to a heightened level, but there is something about not just mothers, but maybe more so mothers, that is at least my mother was so stoic. And I try to, you know, there is an element of that in this that I am trying to communicate to the audience, just in a funny, dramatic, and horrific way. And I don't know that I have other things. It's a unique and funny and unexpected movie, and nothing traditional about it, really.
Deborah Eisenstadt is writer, director, producer, and editor of Imaginary Order at the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Support for the Radio Cafe comes from the Lannan Foundation, presenting a reading and conversation by Deborah Levy with Jonathan Freeman on Wednesday, October 30th at 7 o'clock at the Lensic. Deborah Levy is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and writes fiction, plays, and poetry. The author of beloved books including Hot Milk and Swimming Home, both Man Booker Prize finalists, and Things I Don't Want to Know, her latest novel is The Man Who Saw Everything, longlisted for the 2019 Booker Prize. Tickets available at the Lensic, 988-1234, or lensic.org. And now I'd like to introduce Hunter Burke. He is co-writer, producer, and actor in the film Lost Bayou at the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. And this is a Louisiana story. It's about a woman who's got kind of a messy life, addiction issues, a small child who's being taken care of by other people, and her return home to her father. What's the origin of this story?
Yeah, I think it comes from a desire from the core group of filmmakers that made the film. We all come from this same area in Lafayette, Louisiana, or the Acadiana area. And so we wanted to tell a story that kind of wrapped around our culture, kind of this institution we grew up in, which is Cajun culture. And so that was kind of the impetus behind it all. And then specifically with this story, I think, you know, it resonated with us with kind of between our personal lives. We wanted to tell a story about this particular cultural icon called the Traiteur, which is the faith healer. And so we kind of set about wrapping a narrative, what that would look like around Traiteur. And then kind of just universally at the time when we were writing it was in 2017. Personally for me, it was an exploration of a generational divide between me and my father. He had been diagnosed with cancer not long before that, and I was living away from home. And so it kind of began to take on this reflection of what our relationship was like at one point when I was a child and what it had turned into now that we were adults. And so I kind of set about deep diving about this particular relationship and then projecting a lot of other elements in my life and also the lives of our collaborators, like the addiction, like the, you know, loss, the grieving, all of these things kind of starting to come together to create this unified idea of what the story eventually became. So yeah, it was, unfortunately, it's a lot of different things. I wish I could boil it down to just one, but it seemed like it was a fortuitous confluence of a lot of different things.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting because you get a real sense of place, and it seems like your core group is from Louisiana, as is the lead actress, Terry Weibel. And much of the film takes place, you know, in this houseboat, her father's houseboat on a river. You get such a sense of place. And also, as you say, of time. I mean, the father seems to be so much from another era, and he's a healer, a faith healer. Tell us more about that tradition of healing. I mean, when I hear faith healing, I don't know if it's real. Like, what is it?
Sure, sure. And I'll try my best to describe it and not speak for the icons that do it. But to my understanding, specifically the Traiteur, which is in Cajun culture, a very much revered person in the community. And it's universal as far as gender. You can be a man or a woman. And it's this person that accepts and is called, I guess, essentially to act as a healer for the community. And they use both the power of prayer and also natural remedies to kind of heal different individuals in the community. And one of the unique things about it, I mean, there are so many, but one of the unique things is that it's a family calling. So it's passed down from man to woman and woman to man. And so if my father had it, he would have to pass it down to my sister. But if my mother had it, she could pass it down to me. And then as well as having family prayers are a very big thing as well. There are no two prayers that are alike within the Traiteur community. Everybody has their own personal. And essentially, when you pass down this calling, you pass down the gift of this prayer. So that's kind of, unfortunately, there's a great, well, no, this is not the unfortunate part. The unfortunate part is it's a dying kind of business, so to speak. It's now that we have, you know, such strong advances in scientific medicine, it's most people don't look to their local traiteur anymore to cure their ills. But the great part is if anybody is interested, there's a documentary done by a Louisiana filmmaker called Good for What Ails You. And it's made by a filmmaker named Glenn Petrie. And it's a fascinating deep dive into the lives of these people. And then, yeah, kind of speaking on what you were referencing about the generational divide, it was interesting for us to kind of explore where Cajun culture specifically is at this moment in time, which is there's an older generation who has kind of grown up because of this forced homogenization of America in the 40s during World War II, that they kind of have tucked away their cultural identity but still somehow abide by its archaic rules. And then you have this new generation that is not necessarily adhering to those particular principles and kind of staking out on their own and evolving the culture into something that's kind of more of a postmodern Cajun culture. So that was also something I think we tried to tap into within the relationship between Pop and Gal, is this idea of changing cultural norms within this community. You know, you have this traitor who still adheres to this belief, and then you have his daughter who doesn't necessarily see it that way and kind of takes more of an earthly approach to how she deals with things.
There's a moment where one of the characters, after one of these faith healings, says to another one, "You're not supposed to say thank you." What's that all about?
That's great that you picked that up on. Okay. And this is another unique thing about what traitors do, is that they consider themselves the vessels in which God's healing can flow. And so when you are being healed or being treated by a traitor, it's not them that's doing it. It's the power of God, of the Lord, of the higher power, you know, however you see it. And so to them, thank you, to the traitor, thank you is not necessary because they didn't do anything. They're merely just there to kind of provide a vessel. And so that's kind of a thing, you know, it's not like a hard-earned rule or anything like that. It's just kind of a norm within the community that you're not supposed to thank the traitor for receiving treatment. But there is this really unique other side to that, which is you can always bring them some sort of gift. You can't pay them, you can't thank them, but you can bring them like kind of a knickknack or some sort of totem that may mean something to you. And so if you see in the film, the houseboat is just littered with all of these types of knickknacks and odds and ends that he's received over the years from his healing.
Oh, that's so interesting that's what that set decoration was. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it seems like that is the kind of negation of ego. And if you have ego, you can't probably be a very good healer in the first place.
Exactly. I've never heard it quite put that way, but that's pretty much what it's tapping into there, Charlotte.
Have you experienced that type of thing firsthand?
As a child, and I'll tell you what, and I feel like memory is a tricky thing, especially when we're kids, because I think myself, I have a tendency to mythologize a lot of what I remember. But I did have an experience with traitor, and it was completely fascinating for all of my life. And I feel like I've blown it out of proportion since the years have gone by, because it was so fascinating and so foreign to me at the time. And so, yeah, I think that was, you know, kind of part of that was dipping into a little bit of hero worship with wanting to make a movie about this particular cultural icon. But yeah, it's fascinating. And then this was also great. We had a faith healer who I was able to, I had several faith healers I was able to be put into contact with to do research and speak with about this film. But one particular one would visit our set often, and she kind of acted as a consultant, and she's great. She's whip smart. She's so funny. And she's just so full of introspection concerning all of our culture and where she in particular stands in it.
When you said that, you know, childhood memories are tricky, what's the memory that you're talking about?
Okay. So I remember going to this house, this, you know, house in the middle of nowhere with my dad in St. Martinville, which is this small town outside of Lafayette, Louisiana. And it was dark, and, you know, it was warts. I had warts on my elbow, and it was part of this healing process. And then the traitor prayed over it and rubbed a potato on it, and then went out back and buried the potato and told me to say, I think it was like 3 Hail Marys, and then the warts would be gone. And, you know, a week later, sure enough, they were gone. And so I think the mythologizing comes in with, you know, the house was dark and it was creaky and musty, and the old man seemed like he was a million years old. That's just kind of the legend I've built up in my head about it, when in reality it could have been very well leisurely and ordinary day for this person.
Right. But the warts went away.
The warts went away.
Right, right. Well, it's so interesting to see a Louisiana film with Louisiana actors and script and the whole thing. And, you know, that yours is one of those states like New Mexico that has really been incentivizing its film industry. What does that look like? And how did that, you know, how does that affect you were talking about this group of people that's been working together for a while.
Absolutely. No, that's a great observation. Because I think, like you said, we follow what New Mexico is doing from afar as well, just because of the incentive package. The incentive package is very similar. What they're starting to do, thankfully, the state of Louisiana, I believe it was 10 to 12 years ago, they started kind of putting through these tax incentives. But more recently, I think they figured out they would benefit from some sort of homegrown infrastructure. And so there's a native benefit that we were able to benefit from, well, or in the process of benefiting from. We submitted our taxes and all of that stuff more recently. But kind of what it boils down to is we were able to qualify for a certain percentage because we employed a Louisiana workforce, and then also because we employed, the script was written by a Louisiana native, and we met the minimum budget requirement for a production of a Louisiana native to be eligible for tax incentives. And so this is a great program that they have these days. I'm excited because, yeah, they're encouraging homegrown businesses, homegrown industries to succeed.
And, you know, having those programs also really help you to tell Louisiana stories, which is so important because it's a state that hasn't been fully and totally, you know, homogenized into American consumer culture.
Absolutely. And I think kind of as, you know, as you're saying, the ability to tell Louisiana stories and being from there, you kind of get sometimes, I mean, we grew up with a lot of kind of parody and larger than life representations of Louisiana. I always think of The Waterboy, and I think of what is it? Southern Comfort. It was this Walter Hill movie about Cajuns being really dangerous. And, you know, every culture and every person has seen some sort of kind of strike down in mass media. But it seemed like those movies never were able to tap into the spirit of what Cajun culture is. And I think we kind of not took it upon ourselves, but, you know, wanted to maybe prove to ourselves and also the community that we could do something without indulging in parody or, you know, sinking into lampoon. So, and I think we did a great job with that because it feels, to me as a Cajun, it feels like a legitimate view of how things run down there.
We're talking to Hunter Burke. The film is called Lost Bayou. Hunter is the co-writer, producer, and actor in this film. It's part of the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm so looking forward to the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. I love that, with the spirit that you guys have. I've looked at the lineup. It's some really exciting films. Some films we've been in other festivals with. So I'm excited that we're kind of being able to bring our film to a couple of states over and see that we're not all that unlike.
Right, right. Excellent. Yeah, just a difference in the quantity of water.
That's right. That's right. We can ship some y'all's way. Maybe give us some of that drier climate. We'd love that.
Once again, the film is called Lost Bayou. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. I'd like now to welcome Michelle Noble. She's director and producer of the short documentary Reclamation: The Rise at Standing Rock. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So this is a short documentary about Standing Rock, about the protests that happened there, and kind of the background, who some of these people are and what they're up to. How did you come to make this film and get involved with this whole topic?
Well, I got a call early on from a friend of mine who's an educator on the reservation, and she was telling me about these young people who had organized around the pipeline to resist the pipeline, to do a peaceful resistance of the pipeline. And she said their idea was to unite the tribes for the first time in 150 years and oppose peacefully the pipeline that was going through their treaty land and desecrating their burial sites and ceremonial sites. And I found that remarkable. So I just drove straight from Los Angeles to Standing Rock, 23 hours straight with my camera, and sat down with them over the course of the many months. And it went from a handful of people in summer, or late spring, early summer, to thousands of people by the time it was August. And then by the time the pipeline, they had stopped it, in December, there was 15,000 strong. And so it was really this group of young people that I felt really hadn't, the media had not really focused on them. And I felt like they needed to be seen and heard in their own, in their, what they were about.
Yeah, it's very striking how much of a youth-led movement that whole thing was. And some of these young people, they were willing to put their lives on the line. They were ready to die for their people and the land. And that's not something that happened overnight. It kind of built up to that. Did you see that kind of progression?
Yes, I did. I saw that progression. It began with their desire to protect Mother Earth. And there's a prophecy that Sitting Bull had, that seven generations from his time, that the seventh generation would stand up and unite the tribes to protect Mother Earth. And there's another prophecy that he talks about, which is about the black snake, which the documentary deals with, where they first thought it was the train and the highway and all of this, and now they realize it's the pipeline, the oil. So they feel, these young people feel, not only dedicated, because Indigenous people have been on the forefront of environment and Native rights movements for decades, but they feel particularly committed to this also because of the prophecy. And they went in with prayer and a spiritual way. They felt that this direct action in a peaceful way was the way to do it. And they did it with this open heart. And then they found that with this huge militarized force that was coming at them with pepper spray and water cannons and concussion grenades, they came to a point where they realized that their lives were in jeopardy, and they were doing it anyway because they had made that commitment and they were ready to, as you say, and as they say, die for what they believed in and to protect Mother Earth.
There's such a sense of history playing out over and over, you know, the violence against Native people, the tear gas, the desecration of their graves, the stealing of land, you know, all of this basically extension of manifest destiny in the name of corporate profit. Where is the Dakota Access Pipeline project at now?
Well, because of the election of Trump, he signed a presidential order to continue it. So it's finished. It's leaked three times already, and it's probably going to leak several more times. But the victory that they see is that Standing Rock became a springboard to the awareness of the environmental-led movement by the Indigenous people, and also this unification of all the Native nations that are now focused on this. Also, the pipeline, which was a $3.8 billion project, ended up costing DAPL twice that because of the resistance.
Well, right. And as you say, one of the things that's so striking about the film is all of these people from so many different tribes coming together. And there's a shot of all these different flags from different Indian nations. And this coming together, I mean, what I took away from the film was the sense that these protests were so much, I mean, they were nonviolent protests, even though violence was perpetrated against them. And they were so much about healing, not only the land and the native people, but everybody else who's caught up in like the cycles of violence perpetrated by these corporate entities and their armed forces that support them.
Exactly. There's not only the healing of the land, but the understanding that we all, I mean, the indigenous people are leading us to understand our connection to the land and how we are all connected together. And these Native nations had forgiveness ceremonies and they had unifying ceremonies because some tribes had not spoken to each other for 100 years. So this was very intense and they decided to do this. But I think the takeaway is this, the reason why I called it reclamation is because it's not only their reclaiming of their land, their treaty land, but also the reclaiming of themselves. Because I believe that because the reservation system is designed as a containment system, there's very much isolation between the Native nations. So Standing Rock was a situation also where they could really unify and really see each other for the first time because they had been so dispersed to so many different reservations and their communities had been not only ravaged but also isolated in terms of their cultural and language and customs and music. And so Standing Rock was a great place where they could connect with not only their ancestors and each other, but their culture. And that was really beautiful to see as well.
Has that kept up and have you kept up with the people in the film?
Yes, I have kept up with the people in the film. And it's amazing how much some of the young people had not been exposed to their own language or their music or the stories. And so it was great that they had a lot of exchange. And now some are almost completely fluent in their language that had not been ever exposed to it. And others who were quite expert on it helped those who weren't. And so there's really communities. It's like a lot of beautiful new families, what they consider that Standing Rock created these wonderful rainbow families. So yeah, we're all still in communication. And I'd like to make a bigger movie about it, a bigger film about it. The reason why it's a small film is because I wanted to get the message out. And my idea was to do a red state, blue state kind of festival blast where people in red states who really don't know much about Native history could really understand what happened and to see these young people and to hear them, you know, contemporary young Native voices, which we really don't see in the media very often. So I'd like to, of course, expand it and continue the story of what's happening now because the environment and the Native indigenous rights all over the world, they're still right on the forefront, the front lines of this. This group of young people are still doing that very much so.
How long were you out there?
I was out there from the summer through December, and then I joined them in March in Washington, D.C. for the Native Nations March on Washington against Trump and the pipeline. So I was there from the early beginnings to what we thought was the end, which was the 35 degrees below in December.
The film is called Reclamation, The Rise at Standing Rock. It's a short documentary by Michelle Noble. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's so amazing to have it out and to have people see it and experience a little bit of what I experienced and what we all should take heed about.
So this program has been about the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. They are on the web at santafeindependentfilmfestival.com. The festival runs through Sunday, October 20th. We will see you there. And the Radio Cafe would like to thank its sponsors, the Lannan Foundation, the Lannell Foundation, the Santa Fe Institute, the Lenzic Performing Arts Center, and Southwest Care. Thank you all so much for making the Radio Cafe possible. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.